Welcome to the Reality Revolution. I am your host, Brian Scott. We're introducing a new author to the Reality Revolution Pantheon, and we're going to cover James Freeman, or James Dillette Freeman, who was very, very involved in New Thought circles and was a famous poet. He was called the Poet Laureate to the Moon, or a modern-day Ralph Waldo Emerson. Dillette Freeman has been the most popular of all Unity writers. His poetry has been read by more than 500 million people. He's had work taken to the moon twice, a distinction he shares with no other author. His 1941 prayer for protection was taken aboard Apollo 11 in July 1969 by Lunar Module pilot Edwin E. Aldrin, Jr. Aldrin had the poem with him when he made his historical moonwalk. 2 years later, Jim's 1947 poem, I Am There, went to the moon with Colonel James B. Irwin on Apollo 15. In fact, Irwin left a microfilm copy of the poem on the moon. He's published 12 books, some by Doubleday, Harper & Row, some by Unity Books, The Hilltop Heart, The Case for Reincarnation, and Once Upon a Christmas. His books have been translated into many, many different languages. He is most famous for his poem, I Am There. It was in 1947 that Freeman heard the words that would inspire his most beloved and widely known poem, I Am There. His wife, Catherine, was in the hospital after undergoing surgery for cancer. It was a time of deep personal need. Freeman recalled, I was in great anguish of spirit. When the doctors told him Catherine had terminal cancer, he left the hospital and went to the Silent Unity Prayer and Healing Room at the then Unity headquarters in Kansas City, Missouri. God, he prayed aloud, if you are there, please allow my Catherine to live. Oh God, where are you? Freeman would later recall that he heard a clear, an audible, emphatic voice speak to him. Do you need me? I am there. He looked around to see who was talking, but saw no one. While he bowed his head, he could still hear the words and felt hope and comfort. Upon reflection, Freeman recalled that hospital scene when the doctor emerged from the surgery room. The doctor said, slowly walked over, shook his head, and said, I'm sorry, the cancer has spread. So he takes his wife home, and he's able to stretch it out for about 10 months, and she starts to feel a little bit better. And I will read some of this beautiful poem at the end of this. But today, in particular, I wanted to read his essay on imagination. Imagination is one of the most popular topics on this podcast. In many ways, the Reality Revolution is a school on imagination. We've discussed imagination from so many different variables. In particular, Neville Goddard and his Secret of Imagination, the Power of Imagination, the Use of Imagination, and this profound idea that imagination is God. And once you get that into your consciousness and you are in an imaginative state, you start to feel the presence of an actual living being. And so it's really changed the way I understand God and spirituality. Imagination being the process in which I create my reality has really changed my understanding of reality creation. And I really enjoyed his essay and work on imagination, and I learned a lot more from it. We've also covered imagination from Christian Larson as well, but I think you'll like this one if you want to expand your understandings of imagination. Imagination, the wondrous power of conception. James Dillette Freeman. My imagination and I have had an on and off love affair that began before I can remember. We love one another, and sometimes we can't draw apart. Sometimes we can't get together. Sometimes I come running after her, demanding that she tell me what's going on. Sometimes she comes running after me, demanding that I listen to what I'd rather not hear. I learned long ago that I can't tell her what to say. I have to ask her what she wants to say. Then I have to listen very closely and quickly put down what she tells me. Sometimes, to my wonder and surprise, there spring forth like sparks from a divine fire. Visions of faith, insights of love, truths that I had no forethought of. Imagination has been a rich and wondrous world for me. What a joy it is to have your imagination suddenly reveal to you a truth that was not there before, a beauty you did not see until it revealed itself to you. Sometimes when I stop writing, I feel that I am floating 8 feet above the floor and can't get back down. Imagination is the act or power of forming a mental image, something not present in the senses or never before wholly perceived in reality. Here then is a power that frees us from limitations of our senses. When we imagine something, we have a revelation and a vision, not through our senses, but by the creative action of our mind. Imagination is the power of conception. I fly, but not on wings. I soar, but not through sky. Where no bird ever flings itself in flight, fly I, for birds are bound by air. As to their course of flight, but thought's my thoroughfare, and who can take its height? The power to imagine. We have often heard that we human beings have evolved to be what we are because we have the power to reason. And this is true. Ability to reason has been no small part of the reason we have grown to be what we are. But no less important has been our power to imagine. It has given us the power to see what we may be more than we seem to be, and that our world may have possibilities for growth and change beyond any which it has disclosed. Reason may direct our courses, but it is imagination that tells us yet more is to be found in us and in our world, and entices us to see if we can bring forth what the yet more may be. The imagination of Diatylus conceived and created the inescapable labyrinth in Crete in which he was imprisoned. But his imagination also conceived the waxen wings on which he and his son Icarus rose from its depths. He to creative life, because his imagination was tempered by reason and good judgment, and Icarus to death, because his pride blinded him to the fact that his wings were of wax and would melt when the light of the sun shone fully upon them. Imagination may become a blessing or a curse, depending on how well we have developed some of the other powers of our mind and spirit. We are born with this faculty already highly developed in us, and it is a chief enrichment in our life. It is our imagination that gives us hope of being more than we seem to be. Imagination is the creative faculty of the mind, and many of the most useful, productive, and extraordinary works in the world of us human beings begin as works of the imagination. Think about this, and you will see how true it is. I sit at a desk, which is the work of imagination. I write with a pencil, which is the work of imagination. I write by an electric light, which is the work of imagination. I wear eyeglasses and a watch, which are works of imagination. I wear clothes of 35% polyester, which are all works of imagination. And the ampersand and the etc. are all works of imagination. Our imagination has profound effects on our mental state, and whether we are happy or unhappy persons may depend on as much as what we habitually imagine our world to be as on what our world actually is. However, only when imagination is joined with the will power to do the work, often tedious, to give the images it produces in the mind a physical form in the outer world, can it change the outer world. Still, many of the realest things in our world of things begin as visions of the mind. The law of mind action. One of the great teachings of unity is the law of mind action. Thoughts held in mind produce in the outer after their kind. Charles Fillmore taught over and over that is the law of mind action which shapes our world. Our world is what our mental processes, our senses and perceptions, feelings and emotions, logical thoughts, passionate desires, and imagination decree it to be. Why are there so much misery and pain in our world? I don't know about you, I hope you're more of a positive thinker than I am. I find myself continually thinking thoughts and feelings of fear, worry, anger, guilt, confusion, and in various other negative varieties. I'm constantly trying to turn off such thoughts and turn on more positive ones. But when I turn my thoughts free to go where they will, I often find myself having something negative happening in my imagination. That the imagination of most of us is more likely to be negative than positive is shown by how many words there are in our dictionaries to describe unhappy states than happy ones. Dante's Inferno is much more vivid than his Paradiso. Imagination is the most entertaining and most frightening of all our faculties. It is the conjurer. It can beguile and bewitch us. It can frighten or enlighten us. It can lift us to ecstasy or plunge us to despair. If we let it run unrestrained, it may take over our life. Many of us live in our imagination almost as much as in our outer world. When we have things to meet, instead of meeting them with faithful prayer and firm action, we meet them in our imagination. But what occurs in our imagination may not be all what is actually occurring. Our imagination may just be play-acting what our hope is happening, or what our fear is happening. Our mind is busy every moment. When it is not under our conscious direction, it is just as active as when we are telling it what to think. If we have formed the habit of letting our mind dream up unhappy circumstances and events, it will do so whether we want it to or not. In the early days of Unity, denial was almost as important a part of Unity's methods of prayer as affirmation. Every moment a thought is entering our mind and we are saying yes or no to it. That is why Paul tells us we should try to pray without ceasing, 1 Thessalonians 5:17. Unless we keep our minds consciously turned toward God, we are likely to find that we have formed the habit of drifting unconsciously into troubled and troubling imaginings. Among the powers of the mind, imagination is the magician. We have always believed in magic. We human beings learned long ago that we had a power in us which can call forth the likeness of things, and that if we concentrate it on gaining some single aim and hold to it with all our will, it may call forth the thing itself. That is the magic of prayer, if not the prayer of magic. Human beings have always used this kind of prayer. Imagination and the other powers. Imagination must be combined with other faculties of mind and heart to bring forth the blessings it is capable of achieving. Ideas are just ideas, nothing more, whatever their origin, be it imagination, observation, intuition, reason, or revelation, until we do something with them. Until we have the energy to take the idea, the mental image, and give it form in the world of things. It is a mere wisp of thought without substance or power. When we combine it with some of our other God-given powers, then it may change not only us, but all the world. One of the most imaginative men of this or any other time was Thomas Alva Edison. He showed us by his life and works that great achievements imagination can produce and what it needs to produce them. He said, "Genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration." Life asks more of us than just visualizing some desire and demanding its fulfillment, as if we were spoiled children. We are children, but we are children of God. We need to develop qualities of heart and mind like courage and love and strength and calmness and intelligence. When we have these, we have fulfillment. I have, however, had a number of unusual things happen in my life, making me feel that although I need to develop more powers than my imagination, I should not underestimate the power which comes from keeping a clear vision of what I want and holding to it and pouring my will and energy into bringing it about. For instance, when the time came for me to go to college, the world was at the bottom of the Great Depression and I had been told there would be no money for an education. However, it never occurred to me that I was not going to be a college-educated man, so with only $64 pinned in my vest pocket and no assurance of another penny, I quit my job, got on a bus, and headed for school. I don't believe I've ever felt lower than that evening when I got off the bus, not knowing a soul in town, not having any idea where I would live, or how I would make a living, not even knowing where the university was located. But that very evening, a very strange series of unpredictable events occurred, which made it possible not only for me to stay in school until I graduated, but to graduate with honors, to become a student body president, to win literary contests, and even to have a year's postgraduate work, and with all this, to have a comfortable room with a private bath. 40 years ago, my wife and I lived in a small house and ardently wanted to live in a more beautiful one. We spent many hours looking at new houses, but the ones we longed for cost more than we had. To get to Lee's Summit, Missouri from Unity Village, we often drove on a back road. We didn't even know the name of the road, but behind a white rail fence on the road was a beautiful farmhouse. Behind this was a beautiful tenant house. Behind this was a beautiful white barn. It was all so beautiful that every time we drove by it, we would say, "We just hope those people are taking good care of our house." We had no idea we could afford to live in such a place, but one day a friend who was a real estate agent was visiting us. He said, "Jim, why don't you move to Lee Summit? It would be closer to your work." I said, "Oh, I don't see any reason to live in Lee's Summit. I'm close enough now." But then I added, "Yes, there is a house," and I described it to him. He said, "That's interesting. They want to sell that farm, and I'm the agent." They wanted far more money than we could pay for the farm. But a few months later, they told us they would sell us just enough land, about 2 acres, to include the big house, the little house, and half the barn. And they loaned us the money to buy it. They had to include half the barn because the barn was only 3 feet behind the little house. I wonder if anyone else to buy a house has bought half a barn. I've lived in our house for 40 years. I've had enough such events happen that I have come to believe that if there is not a prayer of magic, there is certainly a magic in prayer, and imagination is no small part of it. Jesus said, "Ask, and it will be given you." I believe this, but I think you will agree that this needs considerable metaphysical interpretation. Unity says there is a law of mind action, and I believe this, but I think this needs explanation too. Powerful as imagination is, it is not powerful enough that by itself it can change our world. It has almost limitless power over our thought world, but over the world of things it has power only when it is combined with other powers. The world is not what it is because we can imagine it to be that. The world we live in is not an imaginary one. We don't change it by creating a mental image of some other world we would rather be in. Nowhere did Jesus say, "According to your imagination, be it done." He said, "According to your faith, be it done to you." The world is what our faith tells us it is. Faith is not imagining. Faith is not making believe that something is that isn't. It is believing and making something be that isn't. Imagination may turn on a light, but faith turns on the power. When we think of imagination, we think of wings. When we think of faith, we think of a rock. Wings can carry us to new adventures, but it is upon the rock of faith that we build a life. Is there a limit to our power of imagination? Thousands of religions have set up thousands of images to show us what God is like. In the 20th chapter of Exodus, God says, "You shall not make for yourself a graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God." We can't imagine God. God imagined us. That is how we came into being. All we can truly say is that God is God. Dreams and daydreams. If we want to see clearly what imagination is and what are its powers and its limits, let us look at our dreams. Here, imagination rules supreme. Do you have any idea how much of our life we spend in dreams? Most of us sleep about 8 hours every night, and psychologists tell us that we are dreaming in at least 4 of them. The ancients taught us there's both dreaming and dreamless slumber. Whether or not we have at least 4 hours of dreams every night and we have almost no idea of what happens in them. We wake from dreams and we remember that in the dream we were living in a world which is not at all the world our senses present to us. A dream world is full of persons and conditions utterly unlike the world where we carry on our life when we are awake. Many ancient people considered their dream world to be as real as their daytime world, or perhaps even more real. The messages brought back from it were believed to have special meaning and power. And the dreams we have when we are sleeping are only part of our dream life. When we are not consciously directing our thinking, as in solving problems or in prayers, we are likely to be imagining something that we are daydreaming. Many persons deny that they daydream, but the fact is that most of us live in our imagination a great deal of the time. Perhaps daydream seems a very unreal name for this real part of our life. Fantasy, another term, does not give a much more substantial feeling, but daydream, I mean the play-acting life we live in our imagination. Life brings us something to meet, and we meet it not by doing things or saying things in the outer world, but by imagining doing and saying things in the inner. Long before we learned to think with words, dreams and fantasies were the forms our thoughts took. When we have something to meet that involves our emotions, we are still likely to think about it in terms of fantasy and dreams. We bring the people and conditions involved onto the stage of our mind, and we act out our response to them in a play that our hopes and desires, our fears and angers write as we perform it. To most of us, I believe the outer life is more real and vivid than the inner one. But sometimes the life we live in our dreams is more exciting than the one we live in the flesh and blood physical world. To some, and for most of us at certain times, this inner life is the one that is most meaningful. Our daydreams may sometimes be negative and may become a way of avoiding rather than meeting our problems, but also they may be positive. Probably most of the world's songs and symphonies, poems, plays, stories, inventions, scientific discoveries, religions, business enterprises, and political movements have begun in dreams and daydreams. Without them, how much less life would be? Sometimes our dreams and daydreams expand and flower and find creative forms that not only enrich the dreamer's life, but also the life of the whole human race. Dreams and imagination had a great role in the founding of Unity. Charles and Myrtle Fillmore both wrote articles about dreams and their interpretations. It, imagination, Mr. Fillmore wrote, is the maker in us of forms and shapes. In contour, your body is the result of your imagination. So every time you look into the glass, you can see yourself as you appear or seem to be in your mind. Cultivate imagination. Be true to the heavenly vision. Picture in your mind continually that which you want to be, and refuse to judge according to appearances. Mr. Fillmore said that although he saw his wife get healing through prayer in the beginning of his search for God, he found the statements of truth teachers so muddled and conflicting that he said to himself, "In this babble, I will go to headquarters. If I am spirit and this God they talk so much about is spirit, we can somehow communicate, or the whole thing is a fraud." He commenced sitting in silence every night at a certain hour and tried to get in touch with God. He kept at this month after month, mentally affirming words and leaving his mind open to receive inspiration. And the time came when he realized that in his dreams, he was finding communication with God as the source of truth and guidance in his life. And unity began. Jesus in parables. Jesus knew the compelling power of imagination. Jesus was a poet. When they asked him what heaven is, he answered that it is like a mustard seed, or a little leaven, or a treasure hidden in a field. That is a poet's answer. When he wanted to show God's relationship to us, he called God our Father. That is a poet's epithet. There is no greater poem in literature than his Sermon on the Mount. When Jesus had a message that he felt was especially important for people to understand, he often delivered his message in the form of a parable. In fact, the Gospels tell us that Jesus said nothing to them without a parable. Disciples asked him, "Why do you speak to them in parables?" Jesus said, "This is why I speak to them in parables, because seeing they do not see, and hearing they do not hear, nor do they understand." Parables are the language of the imagination, a childlike imagination. If you want to see what a powerful influence imagination has on our life, look at children. Children are the embodiment of imagination. They continually retreat into its world. Perhaps it is truer to say that they live in it and only occasionally emerge into our real one. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all tell how Jesus took children in his arms and said that only those who had a mind and spirit like children would enter the kingdom of God. Jesus said to them, "Let the children come to me, do not hinder them, for to such belongs the kingdom of God. Truly I say to you, whoever does not receive the kingdom of God like a child shall not enter it." Mark 10:14-15. Maybe we upright, mature, so sure we know the way men and women should look and see what a child is like. When we were children, I think we knew we were all members of the same universal human family of God. It takes time for us to learn the grown-up language of do's and don'ts, rights and wrongs, hates and fears. We are the children of life and love in a world that life and love has made, and until grown-ups teach us this is not the way it is, we try to live as if it were. If we grown-ups had the courage to believe that love made us and the world, I wonder if that is not the way we and the world would turn out to be. And do we not at least occasionally imagine such a world? We grown-up people, hardened with habit and encased in fact, go from commonplace to commonplace. To children, there are no ordinary things or ordinary people. The most ordinary things are just as wonderful and strange as extraordinary things are. When we are children, we think that things are only partially fact. They are mostly imagination. Facts are just miracles that we have found an explanation for. You and I and everything else in the world have infinite potential. We've not yet learned there are impossibles. Do not ask a child to tell you what is a miracle. He may turn and ask you what in all the world you think is not. Children have faith that they are God's children in God's world. They have to learn after they get here that this world is not divine but mundane. How do they learn this? We grown-ups teach them. We muddy down their faith that this is a good world made by a good God, with our race belief that we are limited beings living in a world of limited resources. Einstein's formula E equals mc² shows how right the children are. How did Einstein arrive at his unbelievable truth? He said that he asked the questions as a child would ask. The central teaching of unity is this: there is only one presence and one power in the universe, God, the good, and omnipotent. I don't think children know any such words, but I think they know how true this is. I think the children know what they are meant to be, for I think there has never been a child who did not feel the stirring of divinity within. They know that they have all they can possibly need to become all they can possibly be, and all they have to do is be what God made them to be. Every child is the product of perfection's hungering to bring forth a perfect thing. And all the forces of heaven and earth converge around the birth to help the child to be more than anything she or he has ever been before. The hunger for perfection. Imagination is one of the ways this hunger for perfection expresses itself. We imagine a better us, a better life, a better world, and we seek to bring it into manifestation. Today we live in an age of imagination. It began about 500 years ago when men began to break down the walls that the church had erected to ensure the unquestioning acceptance of its doctrines, forbidding people to think for themselves. But here and there, intelligent people looked at the church and the world and began to observe and question and wonder. The Bible and other writings were translated out of the Latin that only priests learned into the language the people spoke. Gutenberg invented the printing press, a great work of the imagination, so instead of a few priestly manuscripts, hundreds of books and leaflets were soon scattered around Europe, and thinking men and women could share one another's thoughts. When a little Polish monk named Copernicus published his book asserting that the earth did not stand still but circled around the sun, he wisely arranged for the publication to be delayed until after his death. Soon men like Galileo and Kepler and scores of other astronomers were discovering all sorts of fascinating new truths about the heavens. They are still discovering them. Once Luther had nailed his 95 theses on the door of the castle church in Wittenberg and started the Protestant Reformation, scores of new interpretations of Christianity appeared and are continuing to appear. Unity is one of them. Imagination feeds on its own inventiveness. Discovery leads to yet further discoveries. Every new truth we find throws light on yet newer truths to be found. Röntgen discovered the X-ray in 1895, and Pierre and Marie Curie isolated radium in 1898. The physical world that had seemed so unshakably solid began to fall apart. From this new subatomic world of particles, waves, energy, and emptiness, physicists are extracting ever more marvelous secrets and powers. This last century, especially, has seen a stream of discoveries that have changed every area of our life. We even see new ideas in religion. The old established religions are changing the way they carry out their worship services and are relinquishing their narrow claim to exclusive knowledge of the truth. We see the advent of dozens of new thought religions promoting Hindu and Buddhist ideas like yoga and Zen, but in a Western version that is not an abandonment of the scientific advances which have given us such control of the world of things. They show us how to meet our practical needs as well as how to unfold our spiritual nature. To flourish, imagination must be encouraged to flourish. No, that is not a strong enough statement. Imagination must be left free to roam. It may venture into wilderness, and it must, if it is to chart new roads. We may bemoan the ludicrous, immoral, and dangerous ideas and practices it sometimes may proclaim, and we may call its promoters heretics, hippies, rebels, radicals, atheists, and anarchists, and such they may be. But we must not let our fixed habits of thought and behavior so overwhelm our tolerance that we keep growth from occurring. The church did that, and for more than 1,000 years, the Western world stood still. 2,000 years ago, when a council wanted to kill some people who were presenting the radical new idea that Jesus was Savior, a man named Gamaliel told them, "Keep away from these men and let them alone, for if this plan or this undertaking is of men, they will fail. But if it is of God, you will not be able to overthrow them. You might even be found opposing God," Acts 5:38-39. Toward a new millennium. Most of us today, looking back at the wars and the violence and the misery that have plagued the last 1,000 years, are wondering if there is not a better way for us to live together than we have fashioned in the past. We've created so many wonders that have changed our way of life in so many areas. Can we not devise ways for nations as well as individuals to live together in peace? A couple events have occurred that give us hope. One, a terrible war ended 50 years ago, and the victors, instead of pillaging and ravaging the losers who had started this war, helped them to find prosperity and stability. So much so that today the losers are among the most prosperous and progressive of nations. Two, you may criticize President Truman for dropping the nuclear bomb that ended this war. Consider, however, how the United States then had in its hands a weapon no nation could stand against. But instead of using it to take control of the earth, the United States promoted the United Nations and took its place in this new league, not as a ruling nation, but as one nation alongside other nations. Some who read this may not think the United Nations is an effective organization, but it has lasted almost a half century now, and it has grown. Who can doubt it is a step forward? At least human beings are trying to join in a common effort, whatever their differences of race or religion, to solve problems, to share resources, skills, and powers, to help one another, to better way of life in a world of peace. 500 years ago, our world was a few 100,000 square miles of land, mostly unexplored, hardly any of it mapped, lying flat under a mysterious heaven surrounded by unknown seas. It had edges that you might fall off of if you went too far. 200 years ago, we could travel no faster than a horse could carry us. A yoke of oxen or a water wheel was the limit of our power. 100 years ago, we were still setting out to sea in wooden ships with sails. Today, we make our journeys in ships that fly through the air. We explore the stars. We dream of building cities in space. 12 men have walked on the moon. They flew there in spaceships at thousands of miles an hour, And when the first man climbed down the ladder from his rocket ship onto the moon, we were there with him. We saw his boots kick up moon dust. We heard him exclaim, "That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind." We watch and talk with people on the other side of the earth. We give the sick a new heart and bring them back from death. We have doubled our lifespan. We warm the winter and cool the summer. We have split the infinitesimal atom and laid hold of its incalculable powers. Every single one of our achievements, every single blessing we enjoy only because someone who had come to the farthest edge of knowledge and been told that was as far as anyone could go said, "Perhaps, but I wonder." Someone refused to settle for what seems to be. Someone dared to ask his or her mind, "Have you yet more to reveal?" And in the mind, a light shone and cast a glow. And in that glow, there was yet more to be found. And the age of the creative imagination is only beginning. Do not believe that we will conquer the brute forces of nature and not the brute forces in our own nature. Do not believe that we will find the center of the atom and not our own center. Do not believe that we will master the world outside ourselves and not the world inside ourselves. Has our exploration of the outer world opened windows on infinity? The world within us is no less an infinity. The Master told us, "Seek and you will find." Matthew 7:7. He placed no limits on your growth. He said, "Whatsoever ye shall ask in prayer, believing ye shall receive." Matthew 21:22. A few years ago, I wrote a book entitled The Hilltop Heart. At its end, I stood on the hilltop that is my heart, and I had the vision of the world we are on the way to bringing forth. If we just keep at the task, the human world divine that this man, God, God, man in us can grasp and shape if he but will. A world where the battle is not of men against men, but a man against darkness. A world where brutality becomes brotherhood. A living world, a happy world. A world of works undreamed of. A world that is a fitting habitation for the human heart and mind. A world where nations cooperate with one another and compete with one another, not out of the craving for conquest, but like runners in a race who compete out of the desire to excel. A world where all people have a chance to develop the potential they were born with. A world where you and I are free to live as we will, but where we will to live for one another. The world of which the Master dreamed when he said, "Ye are gods, children of the Most High." What we conceive today, what we imagine with our hearts and minds full of faith and love and strength, will be. We have made it so. We get what we really, really believe. And this is the poem, "I Am There." It is James Freeman's most famous poem, as mentioned earlier. Do you need me? I am there. You cannot see me, yet I am the light you see by. You cannot hear me, yet I speak through your voice. You cannot feel me, yet I am the power at work in your hands. I am at work, though you do not understand my ways. I am at work, though you do not recognize my works. I am not strange visions. I am not mysteries. Only in absolute stillness beyond self can you know me as I am, and then but as a feeling and a faith. Yet I am there. Yet I hear. Yet I answer. When you need me, I am there. Even if you deny me, I am there. Even when you feel most alone, I am there. Even in your fears, I am there. Even in your pain, I am there. I am there when you pray and when you do not pray. I am in you and you are in me. Only in your mind can you feel separate from me, for only in your mind are the mists of yours and mine. Yet only with your mind can you know me and experience me. Empty your heart of empty fears. When you get yourself out of the way, I am there. You can of yourself do nothing, but I can do all. And I am in all. Though you may not see the good, good is there, for I am there. I am there because I have to be, because I am. Only in me does the world have meaning. Only out of me does the world take form. Only because of me does the world go forward. I am the law on which the movement of the stars and the growth of living cells are founded. I am the love that is the law's fulfilling. I am assurance. I am peace. I am oneness. I am the law that you can live by. I am the love that you can cling to. I am your assurance. I am your peace. I am one with you. I am. Though you fail to find me, I do not fail you. Though your faith in me is unsure, my faith in you never wavers, because I know you, because I love you. Beloved, I am there. Thus concludes Imagination, the Wondrous Power of Conception by James Dillette Freeman, and a wonderful explanation and exploration of imagination and its powers. The thing that resonates with me is that childlike aspect of us when we were younger and our imagination ran wild. And it did for me. I had the most incredible fancies of flight within my mind. And it was taken away from me a little bit. I feel like it's back again. Because there's nothing more wonderful than exploring your imagination. And don't let people say that you're lost in some other world, because that is the real world. Your imagination is actually God. It doesn't come out and say that it's God, but it's right there. And if you have some problem that you want to solve, use your imagination. And any time that you want to create something, you're evoking this imagination, and learn how to create. As someone that has slowly learned how to paint and how to write, these are practices that I learned strictly through my own imagination. Nobody else taught me any of these things. And you can learn anything from your imagination. And if you have some sort of problem that you need to solve, go into your imagination and solve it. Do something when you get a chance. Read the Bible, and every time the word Jesus is mentioned, just replace Jesus with imagination, and suddenly it makes a lot more sense. Your imagination is your power, and imagination creates reality. Yes, you can go on flights of fancy that will take you to places of fear, places of anger, places of hate, because all is within the imagination. So you, with your imagination, can create a reality of fear, a scary reality, a reality of pain, or you can shape and craft your world using your imagination. And this idea and understanding and technique and skill is the most fundamental thing that you can learn. As Neville Goddard explains, imagination is the secret to all of our problems, and it is the most important problem for us to solve. Because through our imagination, we have wrought wars, famines, plagues, global warming, all the stuff we see around us that scares us, that disturbs us, is coming from us and our imagination. So now we understand what's happened. We understand in our hearts that we have created this. Instead of just saying, I give up, it's too hard. No, now you know you have the power, and so you can change it, and we can change this world with our imaginations to something wonderful. And I really love that last poem, I Am There. It's just so beautiful. Hope that you enjoyed this. Not sure we'll ever return to James Dillette Freeman unless I find something else, but I was really inspired by that poem and this particular essay on imagination, and I think it really enhances and furthers my understanding of imagination even more in this school of imagination, which is the Reality Revolution. I hope it helped you. Please let me know about your exploration and journey in imagination and how it has affected you, how your imagination has affected the world. Share your stories in the comments. People want to know, if your imagination has changed the world, how did it happen? How do you imagine? How do you integrate your imagination into your real world? Tell me everything. I need to know everything. Please put it in the comments. All episodes of The Reality Revolution can be found at therealityrevolution.com. And welcome to The Reality Revolution.